Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Welcome to the Total Soccer Show. My name is Taylor Rockwell. On today's episode, we're talking a little more Dos Acero. We're talking angry Columbus fans, happy and wet Red Bull supporters, and good times for LAFC. Here with me to do all of those things is a man who rewatched the U.S., has another hour of thoughts to share. It's Joe Lowry. Joe, a pleasant Tyler Adams to you, my friend.
The crazy thing is I probably do have another hour of thoughts to share. I am encouraged that I won't have to do that because we are joined by another lovely gentleman. Taylor, I'm just so glad that I know if there was a rainstorm, you would give me your jacket. That's what I'm thankful for.
Of course I would, Joe. I think you might... It might be that awkward situation of the mascots being taller than the player that is standing in front of them. But I would share my jacket with you all the same. The third individual Joe mentioned, a man who no longer has to entertain the possibility of being a replacement referee. It's David Goss. Hello, David. No getting screamed at by MLS players for making the wrong call for you. Congratulations.
I would be the worst ref because I'd yell back more. I'd be like, my mistake. Did you just dribble out? Was that you? Okay, can we get some level of quality in this game?
I feel like you'd be the sarcastic, like, bemused official. I feel like you'd maybe go a different route. Would you be the aggro ref, or would
I'm
you be the, like,
I'm just
assuming
I treat players the way I treat refs sometimes.
Okay, that's good.
Also, can I go back to, have you guys seen Wet Hot American Summer?
It's been a while, but yes.
There's, like, a great scene, because it's a bad movie, where... Yeah, I know, Joe. I didn't even have to guess on that. That was kind of a question for Taylor.
It's nice of you to include me, Goss, but yeah, let's keep
going. They're, like, out at night, and the guy gives the woman his jacket, because she's cold, and then he gets cold, so then she gives him her sweatshirt, and that's how I would picture you guys just trading jackets in the rain. Because Taylor's cold, and he doesn't want to get wet, so he's stuck in the middle.
That works well. Thank you for that, David. Joe, no Wet Hot American Summer for you? I am shocked. But we do have the end of replacement officials in Major League Soccer. Joe, that solves all the problems. Everything's good again?
I mean, it's helpful. When we're talking about some of the PR hits that MLS has taken this year, and there have been several, let's not get it twisted, the refereeing issues are towards the top of that list. And so the fact that the union and pro could come together and finally find a deal after we have not had the actual, you know, fully qualified referees on the field in an MLS game in 2024... that is literally only a good thing. It seems like the referees got a lot of what they wanted, which is encouraging. It seems like they're going to be compensated at a noticeably higher level. That was the big thing that they were obviously looking for. And as a spectator of Major League Soccer, I am looking forward to seeing, you know, more folks out there on the field who have control of the game, who have respect of the players. And that is, like, one of the main things. You talk to players, you talk to other referees, and I have done both of those things during this time where we haven't seen the refs on the field. Like, the biggest thing is not so much the call, so we'll talk about that later, maybe a bit, but is more the respect, like the ability to control a game, to keep it moving, to keep it flowing in the way that we all sort of know the sport should flow. And these referees who have been drafted or who have scabbed their way into service, like, they don't have that. So it is a good thing for me, sitting on my couch watching a lot of MLS every weekend, to see games that actually feel more like real soccer games.
Scabbed their way into service is quite the phrase. Well done, Joe. If you are pointing to maybe one of the more egregious examples of replacement ref officiating, jumping ahead a little bit, is the Charlotte Columbus game on that list, or is that more correctly officiated than I'm giving it credit for?
So everybody who listens to the show knows that I hate refereeing controversies and conversations, that I think they're boring.
Part of that is also out of ignorance.
I didn't feel like the Derek Jones red card was a red card, but it went to VAR, and VAR clearly recommended that it was. I don't know. It still didn't feel like there was a lot of intent in there, and I don't know that it hits the qualifications to be a red card. Columbus fans in general in that game just had a lot of reasons to be angry. You have two players come off injured in the first half. You lose Christian Ramirez in the 23rd minute and Rudy Camacho in the 18th minute to a turf field that I believe Columbus lost Will Sands on last season to a long-term injury. Like, Goss is shaking his head. No, maybe I misremembered.
No, I have no. I don't remember where his injury was.
It's. I mean, this field out in Charlotte has caused a lot of problems for Columbus specifically. You have all that. You get a goal called off in the first half. You have that Jones red card that I mentioned, and then you have a penalty kick go Charlotte's way. I believe also towards the end of that first half, which was a nothing call, and that absolutely was. I'm confident in saying a real mistake. The Jones one, I kind of get what Vieira is going for there, but I still don't think I agree. Columbus fans just have plenty of reasons to feel aggrieved after that match.
Joe, Goss said that, like, if he were officiating, he would be maybe the type to give
I'd
it
never
back.
Blow the whistle, Taylor. I don't know what to call. Indecisive. I'm making zero decisions on the field.
In a different direction than that, which, yeah, that feels maybe accurate. Yeah. But, like, what I'm curious about is I was going to try to, like, bait you into being angry about the officiating. Joe, do you get angry? Does Joe raise the voice, or is it usually just very even-keeled? Like, even if you're if you got a call, if you were the head coach that you thought was incorrect, I feel like the most we're going to get from you is, like, I disagree with that, but it's fine. We'll figure it out. Is that about how we're going to handle that?
I genuinely think some of the most angry moments of my life have been in, like, youth sports situations as a player, like, as a kid, when the referee I feel has been unjust. Like, I don't think I've ever, think I've raised my voice as much as I have, like, at referees. And even then, it's, you know, it's not super high on that scale. But I can see myself, Taylor, one of the only instances where I would really, like, have a rise gotten out of me would be in a referee, situation where I feel that a wrong call has been made. I can see that happening.
Goss, does this surprise you to hear that Joe Lowry stays even keeled the whole time? No.
Yeah, Joe believes in fairness. And in fairness, he has to always be even keeled. So his temperament is fair to both sides. On the Columbus thing, can I just say, I love that Columbus fans have created this thing where the camera angle of the replay that called off the goal has gotten further and further away into the solar system. So, like, the first time it happened, Columbus fans were tweeting, like, oh, the International Space Station had a shot that called off the Cucho goal, and then it became space, and then it became the Milky Way, and it's, like, moved further and further away, which I respect.
So for people who haven't seen it, it's basically disallowed. Originally, I think they say they're checking for potential handball, but then it's called off for offside, but it's what one camera angle that appears to be from, like,
the upper deck?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, Rosie behind the goal.
Feels like a drone shot, to be honest.
It does not feel like it's part of the broadcast cameras, because it does not feel like it's being operated.
Doesn't really make any sense. And I think that alone is cause for frustration for Columbus supporters then when everything else goes the way it does.
Yeah,
it was a bad day, for sure. I appreciate that they're putting it into creative endeavors as opposed to just raging, although they're doing plenty of that too.
Let me just throw out to Joe's point of, like, the big calls missed. I think it was the RSL Vancouver game of, like, the last 20 minutes were, like, 3 minute stoppage, 3 minute stoppage, 3 minute stoppage of, like, injuries, fake injuries, yelling, annoyance. And that, to me, to what Joe's talking about, is, like, almost worse of, like, there was no flow to the game because the referee couldn't keep it on the tracks. There was no respect. There was not really a relationship. And as the game goes longer and longer and gets tenser and tenser, it just falls off to the point of, like, I can't take anything away from that because I don't know how much soccer was played and, like, how realistic it is going forward. So thankfully, we'll be done with all of that.
Well, speaking of disjointed endings that drag on and have a lack of respect, let's talk about the USA's 2-0 win over Mexico, a game that finishes in somewhat notorious fashion, I don't know the word I want to use there, with the Eltre fans doing the chant, and we get the suspension of play twice, and then the official calling it off. Goss, we don't need to get into the weeds on that one, but we do want to get into the weeds on the result as a whole. Joe and I obviously did a reaction show Sunday night and went pretty long on that game. You were not with us, but I'm sure you have thoughts. So what was your, like, overall takeaway, main thought from that win for the United States?
I think if you're a member of the team, if you're a fan of the team or in the environment, you have to start with being happy. Like, you beat your biggest rival in the biggest game so far since the World Cup. You did it in epic fashion of the Dos Acero, the Tyler Adams goal is a special moment. The Reyna goal is a special moment as well. And you did it fairly comfortably over the course of the 90 minutes with some forced rotation, with some pieces who haven't been around since the World Cup, with some pieces that you're trying to bring in and make more central. That has to be the number one reaction. Number two is I will argue with you every day that you're the second biggest Tyler Adams fan on this show, because I am a lifer since day one Tyler Adams fan and would do anything for him. And to see him come back and have that moment, I cannot stop thinking about Michael Bradley in 2014 World Cup qualifying and 2018 World Cup qualifying, having those goals against Mexico, and for Tyler to have two goals, both against Mexico, and then score that goal after the injuries, after the layoffs, after I said he shouldn't get called into this camp because let him be healthy, let him train with Bournemouth, let him get, you know, his body right. That was such a great moment, and it's great for him to just be out of that darkness and come through. And you heard it in what Gio Reyna said post-game of, like, I've been through stuff like that. I'm so happy for him. We're so happy for him. I think you saw it in the reaction from everyone. So all of the, like, emotional high-level stuff has to be pure excitement and energy coming out of that game.
Seems like you doubted Tyler Adams a lot there for the number one Tyler Adams supporter. I'm just
trying to protect him. I'm just trying to think about, as a parent, what's best for him.
I see. I love that when Goss made that claim, Joe leaned away from his microphone in a, like, oh,
y'all
no.
can have this one.
this is going to go forever. Oh, that goal was very lovely. Joe, Goss said the U.S. did it fairly comfortably. You have rewatched that game.
Sure.
When we talked, I think we both sort of felt like it was a dominant performance in the United States, but that there were chances for Mexico. Maybe there was a little bit more openness to it. How do you feel rewatching?
Yeah, the things that stood out to me most on the rewatch, and I rewatched a bit before we recorded, and I went in back in deep again, you know, between yesterday and today. And the thing that stood out to me the most, Mexico really did look toothless. They had a couple of looks, and any team with a couple of half decent players in Mexico have that, and probably a bit more. Like, they're going to get a couple of those looks against a team like the United States. But man, the U.S.'s defensive structure continues to be, and performances against the ball, continues to be like the single best part of this team. That was the drum I banged all the way up to the last World Cup. Like, the defensive structure was the thing and nobody talked about it. It was sharp again against Mexico. And another thing that stood out to me was how far on the front foot the U.S. were, particularly in the first 15 minutes of the second half, really leading into that Gio Reyna goal. We saw Sergiño Dest unlock something in himself towards the end of the first half where he was getting forward, taking players on. And we saw in the first half as well, for the vast majority of it, Tim Weah not being an impact player. All of a sudden, when Dest turns things on, you get to the second half, he's still driving forward. He's still beating guys on the dribble. And that then allows Tim Weah to go and break into that space in behind, and not just break into it, but get onto the ball as well, because Dest then has a clear sight line to feed Weah on that right wing. So the U.S., they were active, they were engaged, they were aggressive. Was it a perfect performance? No. Is it a performance that tells us a ton about this team, to be honest? Not really. Like, the U.S., and this is still, I think, the biggest takeaway besides being happy about the win. The U.S. is the dominant force in CONCACAF. Mexico is not particularly close to this team right now. They haven't been for some time. Copa America is the test. And there are going to be bumps and bruises along the way. Like, we saw some moments against Jamaica where, yeah, the U.S., not good. We've seen those moments before. We saw them leading up to the World Cup. And we saw moments of focus that dipped in the round of 16 game against the Netherlands. Like, this team is not perfect. They're going to have bad moments against equal or better teams. They have bad moments against bad teams, right? That's how this sport works. But the biggest takeaway is absolutely, what is the Copa America going to look like? Because the U.S. seems to be ready, or at least they have graduated beyond CONCACAF and how they stack up against the better teams in South America. That is much more of an open question.
What's interesting there is, when you take and abstract the two games from Nations League, and it's like they gave up an early goal, they struggled against Jamaica, they beat Mexico fairly cleanly. There's a side of me that's like, yeah, of course, because this sure. team at their worst struggles is being able to link enough passes and break lines to break teams down. There are too many mistakes in there. Like, if you connect seven passes with this U.S. national team, you're going to get a bad touch from someone. Whether it's Weston McKennie, and a lot of that is like just not paying attention at times. Whether it's Pulisic, who is great in space, but gets stuck in tight spots of long first touches. Whether it's whatever center forward's coming back. Whether it's Tyler Adams not being able to break lines. Like, all these players have flaws. If any of them were perfect, they'd be playing for Real Madrid. That's not the case. So that part makes sense to me. Then you go to talk about Copa America, and it's like, well, that's what's going to be required of the U.S. But that wasn't what we saw against the Netherlands and at the end of the World Cup. Like, they struggled in that game to find a foothold or be dangerous on the counter. And so I'm curious to see now, 2 years later, what the case of this team is against high-level teams where they're against the game. Because this Mexico game, they didn't really have to make the game. Like, Mexico was going to come out. They were going to step forward at times because they have to. And there was going to be openings to play through, which made sense. And they get the Tyler Adams goal, which is a little bit of a freak moment that opens things up going into that second half, as you talked about, Joe, where I think Mexico panicked. I think they came into the locker room. Everyone started yelling at each other, and they came out, and they felt like they had to run with their hair on fire, and the U.S. was ready for it. If they're able to do stuff like that against that next step of Uruguay, Colombia, Brazil, all of those things, which in my mind should be a strength of this team because of that defensive structure, because of their ability to run into space, because of a lot of these guys, the clubs they play at, the way they play.
Gus, I suspect I will know Joe's answer to this, so I will ask you instead. Who do you have the most faith in to not make those little mistakes, to not take that heavy touch or to dribble into a situation that does not benefit them? Who do you feel like is most likely to keep the ball moving, find the right pass, find the right first touch?
Moose is the obvious one, but I'd put Weah in there as well.
Joe was just taken aback.
Did you watch the Jamaica game?
For sure.
Taylor said the word pass, and then you answered with Moussa. But just, I'm trying to see where the disconnect is there.
Because I'm still at the first touch.
Okay, fair.
Like, I'm still at controlling the ball to then do whatever you're going to do after.
Yeah.
And I'd say Weah and Moussa are the top two in that conversation.
Yeah.
I think they're the cleanest on the ball. I think they're the safest outlet.
Moussa, when you're talking about being high-pressed, and this is the first thing that jumped off the screen to me when I still remember Tenorio like tweeting out that Moussa was going to be in camp with the U.S. back in 2020, and I didn't know who Yunus Moussa was at the time. I think that probably applied to a lot of USMNT folks out there. And I went in and watched the tape, and he's playing as a right midfielder in a midfield four, like a flat line of four for Valencia at the time, which is, I don't think, a great role for Yunus Moussa. But the thing that jumps out is he's so smooth on the ball. He's able to drop a shoulder and go and progress the ball on the dribble. As a distributor, we obviously saw the weak points in his game against Jamaica, and that really hasn't improved. But guys, I take your point there. Same with Weah, generally someone that you're comfortable with being on the ball in a tight spot. I would say a lot of that applies to Pulisic. But the player that Taylor was alluding to and not giving that question to me is Gio Reyna. Absolutely. And he's the complete player. Like, he is, I strongly believe, the correct answer to that question. And I wrote this for backfield. Like, the U.S. need Gio Reyna. And the issue at the moment is not a personality issue. It's not a locker room issue. We saw great evidence of that after the game. The issue is that they're too reliant on Gio Reyna. And it was a godsend for the U.S. that Tyler Adams put the ball in the back of the net in that first half. And it did sort of feel like something was coming. Pulisic had a few bright moments in the first 45 and in the second 45. There were some good opportunities for players not named Gio Reyna. But man, he is so important to this team, and he is the closest thing they have to a complete midfielder and looks at home playing slightly deeper in midfield.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back to talk more USA, Mexico, and maybe look ahead to Copa America. Back soon.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu. Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. David Goss coming to you to continue to talk about Gio Reyna for a moment. I think when Joe and I left it on the review, we had him as one of the three midfield starters going forward. Maybe Yunus Musa dropping to the bench as a result. How would you feel about that, or where would you like to see Reyna used?
I don't mind that. The performance against Mexico is impressive. Like, I couldn't have told you before that he 100% would fit that role and be able to work hard enough and cover enough ground to make the U.S. good enough where you can't play through them with him at central midfield. So that was really positive for me, because a lot of times when we've talked about, like, who fits where and where players fit in, I worried about Reyna against the ball centrally. And that's where putting him out wide sort of protected him and gave you the ability to use him as an outlet and allow him to attack and float a little because of the way the fullbacks play on this team. I think there's zero doubt that he earned that spot. It's interesting that it's Musa that gets pushed out. I think coming out of the Jamaica game, I think there's a chance, if Dest is unavailable or a left back is unavailable, that Weston McKennie starts at right back right now. And either Dest starts on the left or Dest is out and Jedi starting. Because you take out Musa, and I understand the issues with him, he is still, as I said, this outlet and this this safety net that you have that I think other players aren't. I thought Weston McKennie slept walk through a lot of this Nations League. He is a game changer, but it's only when he's super locked in. And he changes the game in ways where it doesn't go through him. He pops up in moments where he finds that, and it felt like he wasn't really pushing to do that. And then Jamaica game, he gets pushed out wide and floats in a couple crosses, but he wasn't trying to make runs that disorganize defenses, which is what he's so good at, and pop up in spots where he has an advantage. A lot of times physically on the far post, we'll see him nod it back across or score or taking risks. And so I thought he struggled throughout this weekend or week, whatever you want to call it. And I think it's open to who steps in for him, but I thought Reyna was good in there. I really like Malik Tillman against
Gus. Do you think he struggled, or do you think it was just sort of like he was somewhat anonymous? Because I think I wouldn't agree that he struggled, but I hear your point. I think Joe and I in both reviews sort of were like, yeah, Weston was there. He did Weston things. It was good. But I don't think we did a ton of like deep dive analysis on his game and what he did. And I think that might back up your point that maybe he's the
one.
To
me, Weston things are makes an unexpected run through the channel, opens up the game, is the one who tries a Rabona for no reason, is the one that pumps the crowd up, is the one that's when it was him that got tackled by Edson Alvarez. He gets up, he's the one in the face. Yeah, there you go. Maybe that's why. It didn't feel like Weston McKennie things. It felt like a solid soccer game over the course of two matches for him, but no special moments and no pop-out moments. And he, I think, is a little bit too messy to be, and not the Leo one, the one with a Y, to be just a consistent performer. Like, he has to have special moments to be in there. So I think that conversation's open. I thought Tillman was really good. So I wouldn't be shocked if you put Reyna on a wing when you need to and Tillman can connect with him. I think Tillman was looking for someone all of Jamaica game that was Gio Reyna to link up with. Like, he wanted to lay off and move and keep the ball moving and have 2-3 quick touches. Yeah. And no one was around him wanting to do that with him. And I thought that caused some problems. And yeah, I still thought he created some half chances. So he's in that conversation for me, especially if he keeps playing at PSV at the way he is. But it was a special week, I think, for Gio Reyna, and that he proved he could step into that role. I get your point, Joe, of like, don't be that reliant on a guy who can't stay healthy and has been in and out of teams over the course of his life. But I have talked about the national team having a role. And I think for Greg Berhalter to do the thing where he came and defended him, whether it was against Jesse or other people, I think all of that is this role of like Greg Berhalter trying to restart Gio Reyna and be in his corner and push for him. Like, these are these moments where the national team can help your club experience because you need someone to sort of push you and be positive for you at a time when everyone else is negative.
I want to drill back down on the Malik Tillman discussion, because Taylor, I know, came away from that game. I think you were a little bit more passionate about your dislike for his performance against Jamaica than I was, Taylor, but we were both generally in the same corner. I went back through and rewatched, you know, big chunks of that game after we recorded. And he does stand out much more for his ability to link play. Like, his quick touches in the middle third in particular being able to release some pressure and drive forward. He's a guy that you're sort of, he's sort of in that, maybe not quite the Musa category, but like somebody who you do feel pretty comfortable being on the ball in a tight spot to then, and I think he does this far better than Musa, to then play a progressive pass. So I was actually a little bit looking forward to maybe seeing, maybe I don't know. I would like to see Tillman and Reyna at some point get a start together in midfield because I think that could be fun. The thing that I don't think Tillman has in his game, and Taylor, you and I have talked about this several times, is that last piece in the final third. It's the loose touch against Dortmund in the Champions League that somehow lucks into being a penalty kick. It's a loose touch in the 30-something minute against Jamaica the other night where, you know, he does a lot of good work to get in a good spot, and then the final action isn't there. It feels to me like his hit rate on the final ball or the final dribble or whatever is low. But I almost want – I'm glad you brought it up, Gus, because I sort of wanted to Sharpie over my previous take and say after watching a bit more closely and focusing on him more because it was an interesting discussion point after Jamaica – I don't think he should be a starter with this group if everybody's healthy, but I am far more intrigued now to see him getting on the ball and moving forward and to see how he continues to develop with PSV, and I think I'm a bit warmer on his performance now than I was a couple of days ago.
With that final third issue or deficiency, which I would agree with, and I think he also has that shot I would that I will forever go back to. Is that a reps thing then? Is that just the more starts, the more you're in those positions, the more accustomed to them you become? Is that how he improves, you think?
I think so, right? You don't, some players never get that, right? Some players just, it's just not going to happen for them. The vision isn't there. The technique isn't there. Tillman is a creative enough player and seems to have some real ideas on the ball deeper downfield that it makes me optimistic that he can develop at least some of that. To be clear, I think his best spot is very much as a sort of box-to-box free number eight in a midfield three. I don't think he fits great as an eight and a double pivot. He's not a pure number 10, and he's certainly not a winger, despite US Soccer listing him there at times. He's not a forward. Like, he is very much a midfielder who can range, who can cover ground, who can help you win the ball. There's more work for him to do on the defensive side, but I think he has that upside. It is reps. Like, I want to see him get more reps. And I don't think that comes at the expense of Weston McKennie or Gio Reyna, at least not in games you're trying to win. But getting him another start in a friendly or getting him real minutes in one of the pre-Copa America friendlies, if he warrants it with continued improvement at PSV. But I think his upside is there as a player, his technique, his comfortable, you know, ability on the ball. All that stuff does make me like him. I just think maybe this is a case of Goss seeing that there's real upside for him to continue improving that. Taylor, you probably see the same, but see that final third limitation in a very real way. And I see all that stuff, but I am optimistic that I think he can improve some of it with more time.
I see a consistent enthusiasm from USMNT supporters to see what's next, who's next, totally. What's the next guy, who's the next guy. And pulling back the curtain a little bit, I have seen, in terms of the people who cover the USMNT, a consistent feeling that Weston McKennie is, like, putting it bluntly, not particularly
good. Bobby
Warshaw.
Sorry, what happened? I don't know what
dude,
that was.
Bobby's one of them. There are a lot Love of people you, who will say that. And sometimes it feels observed, and it feels like there is reason behind it. Sometimes it feels like a thing that people have heard said and say, and then it kind of gets repeated. I don't really buy into that, but I do buy into David's criticism. I think that's fair. I think, as I said, going back to the way we talked about him, kind of regularly when it comes to the U.S., he's one who I think we don't end up spending a ton of time on unless there are those big moments where the jersey's pulled or he gets into it with somebody or he scores a big goal. I can see where that is coming from. At the same time, I think there can be an inclination for U.S. fans to be like, all right, well, let's move him on. Let's get this guy in because he's promising or he might be able to do this. And I just think that's what U.S. supporters want to see. But it's not really what a coach is ever going to do.
No.
There's always going to be a slow progression. And so I think in some ways, I hear where you're both coming from. I also just think too much change can get us into bad situations
totally.
That we've been in the past.
I think all that's fair. It also just doesn't have anything to do with Malik Tillman and like our evaluation of Malik Tillman. So I think it is totally fair to have reasonable criticisms that you and I have talked about before, after Champions League shows, after the game the other night. Like, Malik Tillman is not a perfect player, and I just said it straight up. He should not be gifted a spot in the starting lineup. I don't think Goss is saying that by any means either. But, like, he is a player that has more to his game maybe than I thought initially and is someone that I would like to see have more in appropriate moments.
And to your point, Taylor, I think there's going to be very little change to this group over the years because they were so young as a core. Like, what is it, 80% of the World Cup team was in this, and that doesn't include Walker Zimmerman, who was hurt. I think Weston McKennie's a leader of this group. I think he's a big game player, and I think he's an emotional leader for this squad. He will always be around it, as he always should be. He's an unorthodox player. Like, that's kind of what I try and get at every time I watch him play. And the way he breaks games is different than the way other soccer players break games. But he needs to do some of that to be a valuable part of the team, because he is not really a keep your head down, keep the ball moving, just be part of the system guy. There are also not a lot of those guys in this U.S. team. So that's where his real value comes from, is like, he is one of the few players that does break games open. It was a little disappointing to me that he didn't do it against Jamaica at all, because those are the types of games where it's like, you're trying to throw everything up against the wall and nothing's breaking through. And normally that's where Weston McKennie clips the ball against Iran, or Weston McKennie makes a third man run that's unexpected, and he's the one who nods it down on the far post, or he steps up in a big set piece moment, or he plays it quickly off a restart. And he didn't do any of those things in that game or the Mexico game, which I think a little bit more understandable in that you were up 1-0, you know, going into halftime. It wasn't really required of him. And that's just where I think he has to have plays like that to be the valuable part of the team. But I agree with you that he will be in there for a while, and it's going to take something really special for most players to break into this team. And I don't think this is a golden generation. I think this is the flow of youth development now, and the way things have shifted, and globalization, and, you know, the connection that a lot of these MLS academies have with bigger European teams, all of these things. So I don't believe this is a golden generation where these players should be locked in for 9 years and this is the national team. But to surpass someone who's in the group, you're going to have to do something really special to break through, or someone's going to have to really fall off. And I think that's going to be a conversation we have for a while now through 2026 into the next cycle.
Well, let's have that conversation now in relation to the Copa America, because I think we kind of all agree there's been a downturn for Mexico. We'll talk a little bit more about them before we move on. But if we're looking at Copa America, I think with the lineup and names written in pen, it feels like, at least under Greg Berhalter, it's going to be Pulisic at left wing. It's going to be Tim Weah at right wing. Are you all in agreement thus far? Do you see anyone else challenging them or breaking through there?
Nope.
No.
Okay. Number 9 is where maybe there is a little bit more of a question mark. Balogun starts against Jamaica. Doesn't do a whole lot. It's Haji Wright against Mexico. There is the Balogun injury question mark that we talked about a little bit in the review. So maybe there's an extenuating circumstance there. Josh Sargent would have been in this camp, but has to pull out due to injury. Ricardo Pepi is in there as well. Do you all feel like that is an area where we don't yet know for sure who is the starter? Or, Goss, do you feel like it is still Balogun's spot to lose?
I think I have the least Balogun stock on this show, so I'm tempted to say it's his spot to lose. I don't believe anyone has taken it, though. Like, I don't know how Pepi takes it by not starting week in and week out. I think Haji Wright earned it because of what he did against Jamaica off the bench. He clearly did not step up and then do it against Mexico. And I think you come out of the Coventry performances and it's like, yeah, this guy can be a game changer off the bench. He can give us a different element. He's kind of a second forward off the wing, a different look when we're chasing games. I don't think you saw anything over the times he started for the U.S. that says he's a starting center forward for this group. So I don't feel. And then Josh Sargent is the other one, which I think is interesting. And I really like what I've seen from Sargent over the last year plus when he's healthy and when I get a grainy stream up and watch for a couple minutes. But he's also a different player. If he's scoring, it's interesting because I think he's the best playmaker out of the center forward position. I think that's why he belongs in the team, because Pulisic and Weah and Weston and Gio, they are all goal scorers. So if you have someone who does his job and can create out of that spot, I think you can compete. If Balogun can do that and score at a higher level, which he's more dangerous, then it's his spot. So I find it hard to think that going into, is it Bolivia in the first game at Copa America?
Yes.
That it's not Balogun's spot, at least to start with.
Yeah, I would agree. I've made my thoughts pretty clear, I think, on Balogun and the fact that I think he still is the
have
best.
Have you sold any stock? Are you floating it to your broker?
I might have floated a few shares, but not much of it. I still have heavy investment into Fellaini and Balogun. Sometimes you got to sell, give yourself a little cushion. But
you
got to
keep the market fluid.
I'm thinking about the greater good economically. I'm thinking about the greater good. I would still have Balogun starting, and I'm guessing that goes to Berhalter as well.
Okay, that is my follow-up question to that. Is like, I don't think there's, short of Balogun getting hurt or just no longer playing and then Josh Sargent scoring two goals a game, like, my assumption is basically the situation is that Balogun is still going to be called up. Pepe's probably still going to be called up. Then there's a third striker, theoretically, as long as form continues, that maybe is Sargent. Maybe Wright is brought in as an option out wide as well. And then it's just who performs the best in camp, yeah. But Balogun still has the edge there. It doesn't feel like there's anything anyone can do really between now and arriving in camp to make a huge difference. I think they can raise their stock, they can raise their estimation, they can put pressure on Berhalter to have to call them in. But I don't think until you see them in training, until you see them fitting into the system, if you're Berhalter, there's anything anyone can do to really cement that as their spot.
No,
do you all agree with that?
I do agree with that, and one more take from me on the nine position. I think Josh Sargent is not going to be in the team this summer. I think Haji Wright did enough in the Jamaica game to be the third striker. And what Haji Wright, that Josh Sargent does not, is has that Josh Sargent does not, is that he can play and be a semi-goal dangerous winger. Like, he's not playing as a number nine in the championship right now. I cannot emphasize that strongly enough. He was playing as a left winger for Coventry City, and he's scoring goals. We saw him come up big in the FA Cup. We've seen him come up big in the championship. Josh Sargent has played winger. He's played wing back. He's done all that stuff. But he hasn't been goal dangerous while doing that. So even though I do like Sargent's game, I don't think his national team career is over by any means. If everybody is healthy, I would be a little surprised, frankly, if it wasn't Balogun, Pepe, and Haji Wright as the three.
Joe, I'll ask you one. I'll ask Goss the other. If Christian Pulisic gets hurt and cannot start at left wing, who is the left wing starter then?
Hate everything about this fictional scenario. I was texting about this somebody the other day. Taylor, it's a great question, to be clear. I was texting about this with somebody yesterday. I don't know. Like, I guess you draft Haji Wright over there. I mean, probably you toss Brendan Aaronson into the lineup, but Berhalter clearly doesn't feel great about that. Like, Aaronson wasn't brought into this camp initially. He's an injury replacement for Luca Della Torre. And I don't know how anybody, frankly, could feel great about Brendan Aaronson starting in a big game for the U.S. right now. So I imagine that's where you go. Maybe you shift the shape a little bit and you go with two forwards.
Well,
maybe you go with Gio. Yeah, I guess maybe that's probably the one
Gio
I was missing.
Out there first.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess you toss another central midfielder on the field and you put Gio Reyna there. But I don't love any of those solutions, to be totally honest.
And then, Goss, the same question, but for Tim Weah. It sounds like the answer would still be Gio Reyna.
Probably.
And then we figure it out from there.
Yeah, I think so. I think what's the other part about Haji Wright playing, I don't know if they'd ever start a game with him as quote-unquote winger. By the way, Josh Sargent has 3 goals this month as a center forward.
I'm not saying he's been bad. I'm just saying he's the fourth
goals
guy
in
the
championship
list.
As a center forward,
he's the fourth guy in the list for a team that's brought traditionally two forwards to big competitions.
Okay.
So,
Is Pulisic's been fantastic on the right? And, like, there's not a ton of logic of, like, oh, yeah, he'll come inside on his left. But he has clearly is super comfortable finishing coming off the right. And that was the switch they made against Jamaica when Haji Wright came on. And that's where, if Tim Weah was out, I think it would be interesting to see who comes in, because I would like to see Pulisic go back out on the right, see what he looks like linking up with Dest, which is a different challenge than what he does with Jedi, because Jedi will always stay wide and Dest wants to come inside, but maybe that gives him a little more variance. But the other thing is, like, I think maybe it makes him a more dangerous goal scorer. It is clearly fit for him at Milan in that position. And a lot of times at Chelsea, a lot of the goals he scored were coming in off the right. So he's a right-footed player. Like, it doesn't make sense to say, oh, yeah, well, that will create chances for him. But it has worked in his career. And I don't think Weah is so comfortable on the left, although he's played there with Juventus, where it's like, yeah, just swap them. Although I'd like to see them swap more often during games. But if Weah is out, that might open the door to be like, okay, let's try this and see what happens.
We've talked about the midfield three quite a bit. It feels like Tyler Adams, if he's fit, is a starter. And then Joe and I had it as Reyna and McKinney. If everybody's fully fit and ready to go, Goss, are you good with that midfield three, or would you have Musa over somebody in there?
I think that's coming out of this weekend. I think that's the starter going into that next camp. Don't think it's locked in. Like, yeah. I think there can be movement. Also, especially, like, will Tyler be fully healthy? Will he be fully available? Weston McKinney's been question marks as well. And then, as we said, my first move on both wings would be to push Reyna there, which probably brings Musa back into the team. But I think what we saw against Mexico, you try and replicate that going forward.
All right. And then Tillman can be in there somewhere. Musa could be in there somewhere. Maybe Johnny. A little concerned about his speed, but we don't need to talk too much about that. I'm going to assume that we all agree that if he's fit, Sergiño Dest is very much starting at the right back spot, and there's not a ton of options behind him at this point. Maybe it is Weston McKennie. I did not think Jedi Robinson had a great performance at left back. That felt personal. It felt like, once again, he heard me say that maybe he was as good as Alfonso Davies and wanted to shut down that speculation pretty quickly. Seems like Matt Turner is going to be our goalkeeper. Center back remains an area of some concern for me. It does feel like going into Copa America, like maybe it's still Tim Ream and Chris Richards. Maybe Miles Robinson just had an off game against Jamaica. We had messages from two different FC Cincinnati supporters who admitted that maybe they were watching through FC Cincinnati tinted glasses, but that he did some things. So I think he's still in the conversation. But I do think if we're looking at just the sort of the haziness, like it's not a concern necessarily, it's not a problem necessarily, but I think number nine and the clear, not having a clear starter there is an area of concern. And then the center back combo and who that should be remains an area of concern for me.
I think it'll probably rotate a ton. What we saw at the World Cup was the center backs were like a matchup based thing. This is a fascinating group stage because I think the US will have over 50% possession against every one of these teams. Like, they weirdly drew Uruguay, who are an elite team at not playing with the ball, though now they have Bielsa, so it might shift a little. And they drew Bolivia, who are basically a CONCACAF team playing in CONMEBOL.
It's so rude.
But it's true, plus CONCACAF.
It's rude to CONCACAF, is what I mean.
So it's an odd setup of, like, they're going to play Brazil and Colombia in friendlies, and then they're going to kind of have to reshift into CONCACAF World Cup qualifying mode for the group stage to then probably shift back out of it. And so I think what we saw with CCV getting the start against Iran at the World Cup and all the ways that Berhalter has talked about it, it will probably be matchup based out of the four center backs that come, of what they do more often and where they think they fit against each opponent. Or you're just rotating because you probably think you can get the results, and then you can sort of get everyone some minutes and figure it out and keep guys healthy as you hopefully go deeper into that tournament.
I'm not opposed to the idea of rotating. I think there is some matchups that warrant that rotation. I'm just struggling to find the player who warrants themselves, like, the idea of being rotated into that back two.
Who's a locked-in starter?
At this point, I just don't see how it still couldn't be Chris Richards and Tim Ream. And that is coming off of me saying, after the Mexico game, that I think Chris Richards was one of the poorer performers for the U.S. He wasn't super good in either one of these games. He had plenty of mistakes, as did Miles Robinson. Tim Ream had some mistakes on the ball, but was generally solid defensively. If we're talking about the best possible lineup for any of these important Copa America games, and even for, you know, one of the tune-ups against either Brazil or Colombia, like, who has made their case to go past Chris Richards, even with his faults? I don't think there's anybody.
I'm not sure there's anybody who's made a clear case. I think it would be interesting, if we're going to stick with Tim Ream, to see what Ream and Robinson looks like, because the only thing I'll say against Jamaica is that it just felt like that whole back line, especially with Dest missing, just didn't seem to have a veteran presence who was organizing, who was commanding things, who was just making sure that the U.S. was doing everything they needed to do. And I do think that's Tim Ream. So I wonder if you have Tim Ream in there, does Miles Robinson look better if he has someone who's sort of taking that responsibility? So he's just doing more of the being a center back and being a speedy center back at that. I think there's a chance that he looks better. I don't know if there's a chance that he looks significantly better than anything we saw from Chris Richards. And I think there's an argument that consistency and having him in there maybe generates some of that form, similar to what we were talking about with Malik Tillman. So, but I think the point stands. I'm not sure there's anybody who's, like, necessarily written in ink, that's the guy. I think it probably would be Ream if he was 29. He is not. And so that remains the concern with him, and the lack of maybe speed if we're playing against a team that does want to play on the break or does want to play in behind. But I still think it's probably him for Copa America, just because I'm not sure there's anybody else who can come close. Would you all have Walker Zimmerman in the conversation if he's back to full fitness by then?
I truly don't
the
care.
Honestly, when I asked that question,
between CCV, Mark McKenzie, Austin Trusty, Walker Zimmerman, I think CCV probably is still with this group. He's been dealing with, I believe Berhalter said he's been dealing with some injury issues, and that is likely the reason why he wasn't brought into this camp. I think he is still a top three center back. I trust he's playing in the Premier League, which people, you know, love. He's playing for a championship team in the Premier League, and it's performing as such. And Mark McKenzie has just never cemented himself as like a real center back option for the U.S. Awesome. And I don't think he's doing that in Belgium right now. Zimmerman can't get on the field. I don't really have a lot of optimism that he's going to be 100% by the time we get to the summer, or he's going to stay 100%, because it seems like he's been out of the lineup more than he's been in it for Gary Smith in Nashville. So, I mean, maybe I'd be totally fine with Walker Zimmerman coming into the U.S. in the summer as the fourth center back. Is that going to happen? I don't know.
Is there, this sounds so dismissive, and it is, so I'll just own it. Is there any country that's more like, oh, when you hear a player is moving there than Belgium? Like, a player moving from Major League Soccer to Belgium every single time, I'm like, okay. And then what? Are they doing that to then move somewhere else? It never feels like a move to Belgium is going to get you consistent looks with the national team. It feels like, okay, that's great. After you've played there for a year, where are you going to go to then get USMNT looks? Like, I hear you, Joe, and I think that is sort of the nature of Belgium, which is a strange thing to say about a nation whose national team is quite good, though I would point out their national team is quite good for having none of them playing in Belgium. So there you go. But yeah, that's the one for me. We'll see what happens with the center back pool. We'll see what happens with the number nine. And then we all had Ethan Horvath in goal, correct? Joe, don't talk. Cool. Matt Turner also winning, I believe, goalkeeper of the Nations League. So
what
more
a,
civil
what
war for
a
him.
Shock.
I know, right?
Played the most games and won it.
My last question, specifically for Goss, I was pretty uncomfortable with talking about the kind of gap in quality between the United States and Mexico, mostly from my background is not a, like, we're the best in your face. I'm not much of a trash talker. Even if my team wins, I think it's sort of like, yeah, but, you know, next time you never know what's going to happen. And I think that colors my ability to be really bullish about this U.S. team. But I do sort of feel like with the quality of this El Tri side, and that's been a talking point for a lot of different people. Joe, I know you were on the Sirius show with Jason and Eric Winalda, and Winalda was talking about that, about how this isn't a particularly good Mexico team. It doesn't take anything away from the U.S.'s performance, but it feels like this is a sort of downward ebb for El Tri right now. And Goss, my sort of awkward contention on the show was that I don't see that closing, because I think there's so much money being pumped into the game here on the domestic side. I think that we're going to continue to see U.S. players going abroad. We have a ton of players abroad right now. That was a point multiple El Tri players. I think Chucky Lozano talked about that, about how many quality players are playing abroad in quality leagues for the United States, and that Mexico doesn't have that right now. Do you feel like this is a gap that will persist for a while, or is this one of those things that can be sort of corrected if you're a Mexican supporter in like 2 to 3 years?
I think the gap is not that big. Okay. And while this is a bad Mexico team, none of us would have been shocked if Mexico won on Sunday, right?
See, going I think Joe and I would have been.
Yeah,
maybe not shocked.
I disagree pretty strong with that.
Really?
But guys, keep going. Yeah.
They're not 51-49. It has opened up since, you know, I guess you could argue the best run the U.S. ever had was like the mid 2000s, which I think was closer, and the U.S. kept getting those performances, but the two teams were really close. One of the things about the Mexican national team that I have always thought, and I still do, is that Liga MX is such a strong, big league that you are always going to get the Henry Martins, Uribe Peraltas, Luis Romo guys of like bounce around and wait, and then they peak really late. Outside of like Walker Zimmerman, there's not a U.S. player that comes into the pool at 28. And then plays as a starter for 4 or 5 years. That is like fairly common coming out of Mexico. And that is, I think, because Liga MX is such a big league that there's enough money to stay in the game as a player, and you're going to stay in your entire career. And then finding the right fit, you're able to accelerate your game later on in your career. And so while we may not sit there at the U17 World Cup and U20 World Cup and say, like, this Mexico group, these players are going to be difference makers going forward, they create depth and players better than what the U.S. does, and better than what a lot of national teams do out of their own league over time. And so when you go into national team situations of like, you have Chaka Rodriguez getting starts for the first time at 29, he's not going to win them games, but he's not going to lose them games. And I think you have situations with other national teams, including the U.S., where, like, Dest is out, and now you've got a situation where Jedi's not playing well. The two fullbacks are losing you games. And Mexico often does not have that. The top-end talent clearly is an issue. I think it was Chuki's point about leaving the country is similar to MLS. The best players on the best teams in Liga MX are not Mexican. They are imported players that play at the highest level. And so you don't have a ton of Mexican players that change the game and the team runs through them. And for the U.S., that's the same in MLS, right? No, none of the designated players really are American, but players leave at young ages and go find teams in a Belgium, in an Austria, in, you know, France, where they can sort of be that guy, or at least can be pushed to feel like the stakes are a little bit higher, where it feels like for some Mexican players in Liga MX, it's like, I didn't have my best day, but Nelson Quiñones won the game for us, and like we won the title. I didn't have my best day, but Gignac won the game for us. And like, that's a reality at a lot of the top teams in Mexico. And I don't think that will change. The only thing that can change is the push to try and get players to go overseas at a younger age. The problem is you play in front of 45,000 fans and make really good money in Mexico. Do you want to go play in Belgium? Do you want to go play in Greece? Do you want to go play in Croatia? Like, why would you make that move? And Mexico, similar to the U.S., is an outlier in that it's not the same as every other country. Playing in Liga MX is not the same as playing in Chile or playing in Uruguay. Like, those leagues have less structure and the experience is not as good. And so those players want to leave immediately. There's like no question. There is a question with Liga MX. I think a rising tide raises all boats. There's a reason Leagues Cup exists. There's a reason Mexico's playing games in the U.S. As the U.S. continues to get better, every CONCACAF team is going to get better because there are players that are eligible for all of those teams. Tavon Gray, I think, is a really good soccer player. That's a player that Jamaica is going to be calling in for 10-plus years now along the back line. There is countless players like that, and I'm going to the GA Cup next week. There will be Mexico scouts and Liga MX scouts at every single game watching players. I think that will continue to improve Mexico and maybe pull it closer to the U.S. And I also think the tie-in with Leagues Cup is like trying to steal a little of what MLS has done well and mix it with a little bit of what Liga MX is doing well. And there's a decent chance that it all ends up together. And whatever MLS has improved, I think Mexico will pull from as well.
So I hear what you're saying. I think I still disagree. I would say I do probably overlook certain players on Mexico because it's like, oh, they're all domestic players. I'm sure they're fine, but they're not like next level difference makers, which it sounds like you would agree with. But you are correct that Liga MX, like I take your point, is a stronger domestic league than probably Major League Soccer, Chile, wherever, as you mentioned. What I still hear, though, Goss, is that you're like, yeah, they have more players coming through at like 27 and 28. Seen through another lens, isn't that more, couldn't you also argue like because they don't have anyone else and they don't know who else to start, so why not roll the dice with this guy? Why not try this guy? Like, I would make the argument that the U.S. has more competition in spots at younger ages. Like, look at the guys we're talking about for number nine, for center back, for depth options out wide. It's younger dudes who are already sort of playing abroad and making a case to be in there. And then Mexico still lack difference makers, playmakers, people who can really take the game on at an individual level and affect that difference. Like, those concerns still seem pretty strong to me. And it doesn't seem like what you're saying corrects those things.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say, like, the fact that Uriel Antuna is in the team is a massive problem. Like, that guy is not an international player. He scores against Cuba all the time, and, like, that's about it. I think that's standard? A fair argument to being, like, if that guy's a starting attacking position player, we're in a lot of trouble. At the same time, Uribe Peralta, like, won an Olympics and was a difference maker in a World Cup as a post-30 international player. So I don't think that pushes you out of the conversation of like being able to be that player, but it does leave the situation of like, how do you get the Diego Lainez's and Chucky Lozano's to hit? Because they need one or two of those guys who are game changers. It was Vela and Chicharito for a little while. Obviously before that you had Pavel Pardo go overseas and decide to play. You had Dos Santos's, although that worked and didn't work in its own way. And those are the one or two pieces that they need to be able to find. But if I'm betting, I would like a situation where I get 180 shots at that. being there are so many Mexican players getting time in a big league like Liga MX.
Yeah, I mean, there's like 180 players on Chivas alone, right? That's why they have like exactly. 145 is the number. Yeah.
That if one of them hits, the national team's okay. Though they're getting enough rolls at the dice that it should hit every so often. And with that one player, they then have the strength and depth to be able to elevate that. Where talk about some teams. I mean, let's talk about Norway. Like, Norway can't get into a tournament with Holland. And not saying Mexico is going to develop the next Holland, but like, they don't have the depth to build a roster to then elevate that player. I think Mexico has that situation. It's about creating those diamonds.
I can hear that. I think for me, what the major reason why I have a hard time with that argument is just that when I think about the L3 teams that, by the way, Joe is like fully, I think, still involved, still here, but I think
I'm just chilling. I'm
back.
Like a listener right now. I'm enjoying. Is this what everybody else feels like? This is awesome.
I think about the L3 teams that I used to be like afraid of, that I was just like, I don't know how we beat this team. Or it always felt like, to your earlier point, Goss, like there was a period in which I was hopeful the U.S. could get a win. It would be great if they did, but I was never expecting a win. And I think the key aspect of that team was Edson Alvarez, Andres Guardado, and Ache Hector Herrera as their three midfielders. And that midfield felt impossible to ever fully count out, ever fully beat. And that quality, the reps they had together, they were just at another level, regardless of where they were playing domestic soccer. Those three could be your difference makers. And I don't feel like we've had a Mexico team that has had that sort of consistency and chemistry since those three. And so maybe it is just developing a couple players that give you that core. But that is maybe the difference for me, is not having those next level players that if you're drafting a combined US-Mexico 11, those three are your midfield three, and it's tough for any of our quality players to get in. Right now, like we did it recently, and what we had, like maybe you could say Ochoa starts, maybe there's an argument for Jimenez starting as a number nine, though he didn't start for Mexico in this window. It's just, I think there's a pretty sizable gap right now that I think it's going to be interesting to see closed, if it does. Joe, any thoughts on this one?
I think it's a fascinating conversation, and I want to do a big thing about it. Like I've campaigned privately and publicly. I would love to get John Arnold or someone else who is incredibly knowledgeable of the space, and Goss, you're a great fit for that as well, on to talk about, you know, how the dynamics of power are changing in this region in a very real way. Taylor's texting, which makes me think he's texting John Arnold right now, because this is a man who takes action.
Michele?
But no, I think you guys have hit a lot of this, and
that's
Goss,
what
some of your
about.
What?
Michele?
Yeah, sure. I don't know. Let's start a group chat, baby. 12-person show. Like, I think, guys, your point about the finances of Liga MX is spot on. So good discussion. Lots more of it to be had.
All right. Guys, thank you for that. That was really interesting. Let's take one more break. We'll talk some MLS when we come back to close things out. Back soon. Today's episode is brought to you by Shopify. On the Total Soccer Show, we often talk about the importance of a manager who can clearly and effectively communicate their tactics and then a squad of players capable of executing that approach, but also adding some individual flair along the way. And that's the same relationship you're getting with Shopify. You tell them how you want things to work or what you need to get done, and they execute the game plan, sometimes even better than you could have expected, with Shopify Magic, their AI-powered all-star. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage to the first real store stage, all the way to the did we just hit over a million orders stage? Shopify is there to help you grow. From what I've heard from family members who use Shopify for their online store, which has evolved into an amazing brick-and-mortar location, Shopify has helped with that growth, and with every step along the way, they've made it easier to process and track orders, run the business day-to-day, and help with long-term growth as well. So whether you're auctioning autographed jerseys or selling custom stadium prints, both of which are awesome, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. From their all-in-one e-commerce platform to their in-person POS system, wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout, up to 36% compared to other leading commerce platforms. And you can sell more with less effort thanks to Shopify Magic, the aforementioned AI-powered all-star. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the United States and is the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Plus, their extensive help resources are there to support your success every step of the way, because businesses that grow Grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial at shopify.com/TSS. That's all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/TSS now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. One more time, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/TSS. Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 U.S.-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer, if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. Welcome back to the Total Soccer Show. Joe was somewhat quieter to close out that segment. I'm assuming because he's still recuperating from watching every single game in the Western Conference. Joe, how's that working for you? How does it feel to be the Graham Ruthven of Major League Soccer?
You know what? Graham carries a heavy load, and I'm experiencing the full weight of that. No, I'm not, actually, because I'm not watching like Macedonian sixth-tier soccer like Graham does. It's been a lot. For those of you who don't know, Ben Wright and I are doing over on Backheel a combined couple of pieces every Monday where we cover every team in the league, which means watching every team in the league, because that's something that I believe strongly is important. If you're going to write about soccer, you should probably watch the soccer. It's honestly usually fine, except for weekends where I have a Phoenix Rising game at 7:30 p.m. on Saturday to color commentate, and then a U.S. men's national team game at 6:15 on Sunday evening to watch, record, and write about after. Other than that, it's going great, Taylor. It's awesome.
Yeah, remind me not to complain about being busy to Joe Lowry, the man who has 14 different hats on at any given moment, including one right now. Joe, let's talk about the MLS West for a moment, though, starting with LAFC, who scored goals. They woke up. They're around. They're doing things.
Finally, I wrote for Backheel, not this past weekend, obviously, but the weekend before, that I felt like Steve Cherundolo really needed another attacker on the field. They've run basically four midfielders. Two of them are best as defensive midfielders. No true number nine, and a right winger in Kike Oliveira, who still hasn't fully come into his own. It seems to me like he's sort of put his own team behind the eight ball, although the front office has kind of done that for him in terms of the DP usage. But there have been problems to go around. It was nice then to see against Nashville in a 5-0 win, the worst defeat in Nashville SC history, dating back to their USL days. They've never lost a game by 5 goals. They've only ever lost a game by 4 goals twice in their entire club history. So this was historic for Nashville in the worst way. It was nice to see LAFC's talent that is very real in this team, despite its flaws, actually come through. And I felt like this was more of the LAFC team that we saw in moments against Seattle to start the season. Denny Bouanga looked unreal on the left wing, finding spots, like scoring goals, hitting the post, slaloming through players. He was absolutely fantastic for them. 2 goals, I believe, and an assist in this game. The attack flowed. Like, they looked comfortable, and that was a lot of Nashville looking really, really bad. But it was also a nice reminder of what LAFC can be, even with this incomplete squad. Different fullbacks, and I think this might be one of the keys for this team. We saw Ryan Hollingshead over on the left side, who provides more defensive stability than Omar Campos, who was out with Mexico's U23s for the international break. We saw Sergi Palencia on the right side. Something about those two players mixed with the personnel and maybe the opponent, like, really created a lot of joy for LAFC. But man, I have not wavered, despite my belief that Cherundolo has not always set up this team for success, either last season or this season. Now you can go back a little bit further as well. Despite that fact, I still believe that this team is probably the best team in the Western Conference. Maybe the Galaxy are up there. But like, once LAFC get their two DPs this summer, they're going to be really, really good.
Asking this question fully as like an ignorant outsider, I want to make that clear up front. Prior to this game for LAFC, I feel like I saw some rumblings about Cherundolo and about how maybe we talked about Jesse Marsh doesn't want to take an MLS gig, but like, maybe Marsh should be there. Maybe Greg Berhalter should take over LAFC. Maybe they should throw a ton of money at him. Do either of you feel like Steve Cherundolo is going to be on the hot seat this season, or is that sort of just the fan reaction to a perceived slow start?
I don't think it's just the fan reaction. Like, I think it's to Joe's point of they've set themselves up sometimes in ways that haven't helped themselves, and they don't really play entertaining soccer anymore. But everything the front office is doing is tied into Steve Cherundolo. And so if you let Steve Cherundolo go because the team's not good enough, the next look is like, hey, the team's not, like Joe said, I'd like to see more attackers on the field. Who's that? Nathan Ordaz? David Martinez, who's an 18-year-old
Yes, the answer is yes to either one of those.
Right, but like, that becomes then the question to John Thorington and his group is like,
do something.
Cherundolo's gone and they're not better? So I think it's all connected. I think they have, they are playing with house money, right? They've been, they've won MLS Cup. They went to the MLS Cup final. They've been to a CCL final. Like, there is a little bit of space to work with where Bob Bradley hadn't gotten over that hump. So maybe he, shockingly, for the guy who built the team out of nothing and made it a record-setting team, maybe he has even more weight there. Plus, he's a younger coach that I they hope will be around for a while. So I think he's safe. I think he's fine. I think every complaint about what he does and the way the team plays is completely fair, whether it's from fans or analysts or other teams, and whatever it is. I think all of that's completely fair, but they're, it feels like they're in lockstep right now. And if Joe's right and they do bring in the two DPs in the summer, and if it's Olivier Giroud or someone at that level, another big piece, and it remains bad, I would be shocked if he does not start 2025 as the head coach of LAFC. Okay.
I'm going to continue to wear my ignorant outsider hat, Joe, to ask you the best possible question I think a host with specific information can ask.
Oh, I love this.
Who is Fidel Barajas and why should I be excited about him?
All right, let's go. I'm guessing this is a topic that Goss and I are both passionate about. 17-year-old Mexican-American from California, was at one point in the San Jose Earthquakes Academy and then made the decision to head over to the Charleston Battery, where he was one of the best attackers, regardless of age, in the USL Championship last season, was a big part of leading that team all the way to the USL Championship final. He
Did
was
they
away.
Win?
No, they lost to the greatest club in the USL Championship. Thank you for that alley-oop, David. I believe Barajas was out with the with Mexico and the U-17s at the World Cup during the USL Championship final. But like, he is a hot prospect in that age group. He turns 18 next month, signed with RSL over the offseason. And RSL have done a better job than basically any team in MLS, and Minnesota deserves some credit here as well. But they've done a better job than any team in the league of going out and finding talent in the lower divisions. In the United States, they snagged Diego Luna from El Paso Locomotive in the championship, and they signed Barajas from the Battery, as I mentioned. He is a left-footed attacker, not a true winger, much more of a kind of half-space guy. He can be a bit wider, but he doesn't have elite speed to the point where you feel awesome about him being like boots on the chalk all the time to take a touch and then like take a big touch around somebody. But he is super creative, and you could see it in his first start of the year. Diego Luna off with the US U-23s, who had a pretty darn good window as they get ready for the Olympics. And he starts on the left side of what was really more of like a 3-4-3 in possession from Pablo Mascherini, where we saw Chicho Arango more in the right half space and Barajas more in the left half space. Barajas gets on the ball out on that left side, and he's playing more as a traditional player, like on the side of his dominant foot. And his vision and ability to wait the right pass into the path of his teammates was on display early and often throughout this entire match. And the best moment is the assist he has to Anderson Julio, 70-something minute. Maybe it is just the 70th minute. It is perfect. Like, it is a perfect ball through traffic to find an on-rushing attacker. I am a huge fan of Barajas this game. He's not the finished product. He still has a lot of improving to do, and I don't think he's a regular starter for this team. But I think he's adjusted to this level in terms of his speed of thought and his speed of play way better than I thought he was going to be. He is a top prospect. Both the U.S. and Mexico want this kid badly.
Gus, do you share this enthusiasm?
Yeah, he's considered the top player in the Mexican national team pool at that age. So it shows you like how highly he's valued. As Joe said, the surprise is he's a slight player. He's a technical player. You come into Major League Soccer, that can be an issue. He has a high enough soccer IQ that he's able to work around a lot of that in an RSL team as well that hasn't really found its feet in possession. Like, you've seen early on in his career, he comes off the bench and he is a connector for a team of much more veteran players because he's such a high IQ soccer player. He's so clean on the ball and he's so technical. And then you add in the ability to be able to play these passes where it's those moments where everyone knows it's coming and he hits it so clean that it still gets through. And that's like that high, high level stuff. It'll be interesting to see anytime we see him with Diego Luna, like how they mix together, because I think both of them are quote unquote wide players that like to come inside and have the game run through them. And so it would be fun to watch them interchange and swap and move around. But RSL, as Joe mentioned, I think for them, when you go into a conversation with Fidel Barajas, it's like, you're going to get a shot here. There are a lot of other teams that will say they want to sign you. They will not play you. And if they play you, they will not play you in central positions. They will not give you a chance to run the game. They gave Diego Luna that chance, and now I think they're at the front of the line when they go into these conversations with players like this, of saying like, this is for real. We believe in you. And if we say that, this is what we mean, because this is what we've done in the past. So it was a fantastic signing by them. It was a surprising one to me. And now it makes sense in the what him and his team are seeing from what RSL has done in the past and what Luna's opportunities were. And yeah, he's phenomenal. He has to be in the team more often. I don't think he's a full-time starter yet, because he has to earn that. And like, the MLS season is a grind. And as a young player, you have to build up to that. But he is definitely a difference maker. And already him, Luna, Andres Gomez, RSL has some really fun pieces going forward.
Joe, in terms of players who seem legit and can be big pieces for their team, would Jonathan Rodriguez be that for Portland for you?
Absolutely. He was really, really good. Signed as a DP for the Timbers. This is, just in case somebody doesn't recognize the name, and I'll just use this once. This is Cabecita, coming from Club America. Apparently, he doesn't like being called Cabecita, but just so the people actually know who we're talking about.
Why doesn't he like it?
It's a nickname. I think it's sort of in all in good fun, but it's a nickname that like makes fun of the fact that his head is actually gigantic and not small, as the name maybe implies. That's my understanding, but I don't really know. It seems like he would rather be called Jonathan or like Jonathan Rodriguez. He starts up top, DP, about $4 million transfer from Club America, Uruguayan, and he was awesome. Like, this team last year got no production from their DPs not named Evander. Talked about this in the previews that we did. Like, Nia Skoda and Jimmy Chara gave them 2 goals combined last season as the other two DPs. It's tragic. So almost anything was going to help raise this team's ceiling. And he was so good, Jonathan Rodriguez, at the top of Phil Neville's 4-2-3-1. The Timbers, I thought pretty clearly, were the better team against the Union, though Philly do pick up their first win in that 3-1 Union away win at Providence Park. Rodriguez scores a goal. It's a nice finish. But also his constant ability to find space in the box, to reposition himself, to go and look for gaps. It was all very, very high level for this league. He's going to be a guy who hits double-digit goals despite even coming in late.
Why did you feel like the Timbers were the better team in a 3-1 loss?
Created more chances and generally had the flow of the game on their side. Like, I just didn't think the Union created super dangerous scoring opportunities. They have the advantage of going up first, which, you know, changes the game state a little bit. But I think if you go back there and watch the game, you'll see a few defensive errors from the Timbers, which is still probably the biggest concern in terms of closing down the ball. But it was a lot of one-way traffic in this game.
Oh, those passing numbers are different, put it that way. 168 accurate passes for Philly, 582 for Portland. Yeah, that gives you a sense of who controlled that game. Goss, any other individuals to note? Should we talk Insigne for a moment?
Yeah, unfortunately, the flip side for Toronto, because Rodriguez was phenomenal and Portland's getting healthy now. Mora is back. Evander's playing consistently. Eric Williamson is back in the conversation. Everything going up there with Insigne, he came off with what we're being told is a hamstring injury right before halftime, I believe, and then he got an MRI. We still haven't seen it, but this team is built purely on, we're going to be harder to play against than we were last year. We're going to work hard for each other. And then Insigne is the best player on the field. It has been true. Like, he was brought in to be that. He's the highest paid player, transfer, everything outside of like Messi in MLS history. He's an Italian national team starter. Like, he won a Euros. He is that good. If he's hurt, it changes things a lot, because this team has no depth. Not just to cover for that level of quality, to then change who they are. Because that's the other option, is like, okay, Insigne's out. Let's shift what we do for a little while until he gets back. There are no options in this team. This is one of the thinnest teams in the league, and it's understandable. Herdman just came in. They sort of spent themselves into a hole with the previous, well, not previous management, because Bill Manning is still there, and so it's the same management somehow. The coach got fired, and that's it. So they are sort of playing behind the eight ball. They found one trick that worked for them. I don't know that they have a second one. And so you go from all this positivity, and I think a sell to the ownership in the summer, and being like, look, now we're doing it right. Invest in us. Let us build that back up a team like we had in 2016 and 17 and 18, where we were bringing in high-level internationals to play at other positions outside of the DP spots, to they could be outside the playoff spot with no hopes of getting better if Insigne is out long-term in the summer, and I don't know where that sell comes from. So far, I think for Herdman, it's a dangerous moment, because he's sort of operates on vibes and energy going in the right direction, and everything we've heard, both in Canada and his previous stops, and all those were national teams, so it's different, was when it's good, it's great. And when it's bad, you start to see the holes in what he's trying to do. And the rah-rah doesn't fall. When a guy brings a sword in and you've just lost 4-0, no one really wants to talk about it or look at it. So that's sort of the dangerous moment that TFC sits in right now. I think Bernadeschi can provide a ton, but the hope was you had the two of them playing off each other.
Final game that I wanted to ask you all about. My assumption was that the Red Bulls 4-0 win over Inter Miami would be a thing that both of you all were excited to discuss. It feels like that is not the case. And now my question is basically, Joe, why? Why don't we want to talk about this one?
It feels like this game, more than most, was affected in a big way by the international break. That makes it a little hard to read too much into it. Now, both teams missing big players. Mm-hmm. You had Inter Miami not missing Leo Messi to Argentina duty, but that's only because he's injured. Emil Forsberg off with Sweden. Like, these teams, and there's a bunch of other players from Miami as well. These teams just straight up aren't the ones that we're going to see in other big games this season. So that makes it hard to read into it. I mean, I got nothing against this game. It just feels like Inter Miami maybe are always the default. And when there are other interesting things to talk about, especially in an international break, when it's not the real Inter Miami team, it's not the worst thing to go and look for other things to talk about around the league. Credit to a couple of people. Credit to Lewis Morgan, who scores a hat-trick, was very, very good in this game as part of a front two with Dante Van Zier, who was also excellent in this game. Those two worked off of each other very, very well in that front line for Sandro Schwartz. Like, a lot to like about what we've seen from the Red Bulls, and in general, a team that looks excellent and like a definite playoff team, and potentially a team that's going to end up with a home game in the postseason by the time everything is done and dusted. For Miami, it's just a lot of the same concerns that we've had. Is the depth good enough? Like, Tata Martino had to go down, you know, 4, 5, 6 players in a central midfield depth chart to get to Lawson Sunderland to start in this game as the left-sided number 8. He's missing Gomez, Kramaski, like, Ruiz didn't play in this game. Like, he's missing so many pieces. Redondo wasn't there. Like, this is just a very different Miami team, but a team that's going to have problems whenever Messi isn't in the 11, because their defensive technique and their defensive ability from the individuals isn't strong enough yet. Like, Tomas Aviles is really at fault for one of the goals. He misplays a pass and then takes forever to get back into shape on the right side from Miami. Like, they're too dependent on straight up poor defensive players right now, even though I'm a big fan of Aviles and his upside in particular. Like, it's just a lot of the same Miami stuff. Morgan gets on a heater finishing-wise, and this one gets out of control pretty quickly.
On the Aviles thing, I just want to throw out there, brought to you by the same organization or Tata Martino who brought you Leandro Gonzalez Perez, who was, in when locked in,
he's
and
got
good,
a type.
One of the best center backs. Insanely talented, extremely inconsistent. And I'm over the month and a half, I'm like, yeah, Aviles is way younger, so he might grow out of a lot of this. But it seems like, as Joe said, he has a type. Red Bulls have Orlando, Cincinnati, Chicago, and LAFC coming up. I say that because...
you hate the Red Bulls?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And all of those matchups are different. And what's interesting about the Red Bulls right now is, do they have a curveball in playing in more possession or with Lewis Morgan and Forsberg and Van Zier more attacking quality? Or can they be two different teams in different matchups? And, like, can they do it for high-level, long, sustained time? They did that against Inter Miami. Some of those matchups will require that, and some, like Cincinnati, you probably lean into the car crash, and you go super Red Bull, and you try and win that way. But LAFC, it's been made evident, are going to give you the ball. Can they take advantage of a team like that? Orlando are kind of a neutral team. They let you dictate the game. How do they go out and try and dictate that game against a team like that? I think we're going to learn a lot over these next four games. Unquestionably, the talent level is higher for them. Bringing Lewis Morgan back alone into the team from last year would have made them better. Like, they were a 4 seed 2 years ago. He had 15 or 20 combined goals and assists. He's really good. Forsberg now adds that, a bunch of other pieces. But I think we're going to learn a lot about them over the next month. And if you're a Red Bull fan, you should be very excited. And if you see what you're hoping to see over that month, it's every reason to believe that they can be an MLS Cup contender, because their baseline, their defense, their backline, Cornell, all of that is MLS Cup contender quality. It's only the questions of how they treat different opponents, where in the playoffs you start to get different looks. Teams are zeroed in on you. They've got plenty of time to prepare and all of that. And do they have that finishing quality?
You mentioned Forsberg there, who's been very important for them. He's away on international duty. Do we assume that he notified the Red Bulls that he would be gone for this one?
Nah.
I'm not touching it.
No? So it's just his family that he doesn't notify there, and he's doing things? Cool. Okay, cool. Just making sure. For people who don't know what I'm talking about, Google it, because nobody wants to get sued. Joe Lowry, thank you for all your thoughts on the USA, on Mexico, and on Major League Soccer today.
This is awesome, Taylor. Thank you.
David Goss, you sure? You don't want to mention? You don't want to get into the weeds on that one?
Happy Tyler Adams to you.
Listeners, happy Tyler Adams to you all, and happy West of the Kitty to you all as well. We'll talk to you.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.